Great. And if you do know, let me know so the speakers and myself can unmute ourselves. But in the meantime, if everyone can please press star 6 to mute your line so that we can clearly hear the speakers. Thank you. Well, I want to welcome everyone to the Interfaith Immigration Coalition's monthly webinar. This month's webinar is going to be focusing on the Family Unity Waiver. First, I just want to make sure that we have our speakers on the line. Thomas, Reverend Rosanna, and Ellen, are you all there?
Tom Elliott is here.
Great.
This is Ellen. I'm on the line.
Great. And Rosanna, are you online?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. So just a few housekeeping matters before we jump into things. If Noel is able to use the little trick we just learned, we're going to be in Q&A mode, in that case, everyone will actually be on mute. So if we do enter that mode, when you do speak, please press star 6. Otherwise, we won't be able to hear you. Also, as you can see from the screen on the webinar, there's a little chat box in the lower right-hand corner. As we move along, feel free to ask questions and comment, and we will be able to communicate with you through that chat box. At the end of the presentations that we have, participants will have an opportunity to ask questions of the speakers. So please press star 6 to unmute yourself so we can hear you ask your question. And also, before asking any question, please state your name, affiliation, and location so we can identify you. So I'm going to begin today by just providing a brief introduction on today's topic of the Family Unity Waiver. While many individuals waiting to reunite with family members in the United States reside overseas, some are already living here, working and contributing to our communities. Current law requires many authorized immigrants eligible for permanent family-based visas to return to their home countries to obtain their visas. However, as a result of their time in the United States as undocumented immigrants, when they leave the United States, they trigger a 3 or 10 year bar to admission. These bars can be waived, but waiver applications must be submitted abroad after immigrants have departed the United States. Separation from family members and the uncertainty of waiver process discourage many immigrants from coming forward. On April 2, 2012, DHS took an important first step to correct this Catch-22 situation by proposing a rule on provisional unlawful presence waivers. The proposed rule would permit spouses and adult children of U.S. citizens to apply for unlawful presence waivers from within the United States. It would reduce the lengthy separation time families currently face and encourage eligible family members to come forward. So with that, I want to again just remind everyone to please press star 6 to keep yourselves on mute. And also as a courtesy, please do not put us on hold so we don't hear the background music that comes up when someone presses hold.
Chelsea, this is Noel. I'm going to press star 7. Which means that the speakers or the people needing questions will need to press star 6 to unmute themselves when they speak, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Here we go.
Great. So hopefully, can I just get an affirmative confirmation that you can all still hear me? If the speakers can please press star 6, and Noel as well, please press star 6.
Yes, we can hear you.
Great.
Yes, this is Tom Elliott.
Great. So it looks like we're in Q&A mode now, so everyone is on mute except for the speakers. Great. I'm going to begin by just giving a short introduction of the speakers that we have for today's call. Thomas Elliott is an immigration attorney with Leichman & Elliott. Mr. Elliott practices immigration law as a partner with the firm of Leichman and Elliott in Washington, D.C. He began practicing immigration law in 1974 for the legal services of the Virgin Islands of the United States. From 1979 to 1980, Mr. Elliott served as an attorney advisor to the Board of Immigration Appeals. Since 1980, Mr. Elliott has been in private immigration practice, representing a broad spectrum of immigration issues involving family, employment, and removal defense. He is best known for successfully defending foreign nationals involving difficult issues before the immigration courts and federal courts. He is listed in Best Lawyers in America and Super Lawyers. As a speaker, we also have Reverend Rosanna Panizo, pastor and community developer for the Corridor District of the North Carolina Annual Conference. Reverend Panizo is a United Methodist missionary through the National Plan for Hispanic Latino Ministry, serving as pastor and community developer in the Durham District of the North Carolina Annual Conference. She was commissioned in October 2009. Rosanna has a special emphasis on developing the Cristo Vive Durham Hispanic Ministry into a comprehensive community-based ministry for the local Hispanic Latino population. In this effort, she works closely with other clergy and pastoral leaders. As a speaker, we also have Ellen Gallagher, Senior Ombudsman for the Department of Homeland Security Office of the CIS Ombudsman. Ms. Gallagher joined the Office of the Ombudsman on July 2, 2012. Prior to doing so, she worked for the former Immigration and Nationalization Service and the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service. Ms. Gallagher entered on duty as a trial attorney in March 1995 in New York City. She later served as senior legal advisor in the INS Office of Congressional Relations and special counsel to the USCIS Chief Counsel. In 2007, Ms. Gallagher was detailed to the Senate Judiciary Committee, where she worked on behalf of Chairman Patrick Leahy. 2 years later, she served for 1 year as senior advisor to the USCIS Associate Director for Field Operations. Ms. Gallagher is a graduate of Harvard University and Northeastern School of Law. So with that, I want to thank everyone for joining the conference call and the webinar, and a big thank you to the speakers we have for today. With that, I'm going to invite Thomas to begin by talking about the Family Unity Waiver. Thomas?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you all. Pleasure to be before you all today to discuss some very topical matters. What I wanted to begin with is exactly what the waiver, traditional waiver that we're used to under 212A9B, one is the unlawful presence bar, and the waiver is under 212A9B5. And specifically, for all of you that probably already know this, but for purposes of this recording, for those who are learning, this waiver is for immigrants who are the spouse or son or daughter of a United States citizen or of an alien lawfully admitted for permanent residence, if it is established to the satisfaction of the USCIS that the refusal of admission to such immigrant alien would result in extreme hardship to the citizen or lawfully resident spouse or parent of such alien. So in other words, as we all know, that the waiver is not available to alien parents, to non-citizen parents who happen to have U.S. citizen or permanent resident children. There is no waiver under the unlawful presence waiver provisions. And that does not change with the new provisions of provisional unlawful presence waivers proposed in the rule that was mentioned that was promulgated on April 2nd of this year. So the genesis, and I wanted to go through how this came about and what it is we're left with in the proposed rule to get a good idea of what to expect. It started, of course, on January 6th when the Obama administration announced that they were going to help alleviate some of the true hardships of separation in the family unity waiver, that is, the unlawful presence waiver, the form I-601. So they posted a notice of intent of their intention to come up with certain rules and regulations that would implement this policy. Go to the next slide, please. Now, this involves, of course, family members who are petitioning one another, and generally, of course, we all know that U.S. citizens and permanent residents have various preference categories under the family-based preferences that they can sponsor their immediate family. Because many of you have situations where the person has been out of status or entered without inspection and therefore accrued unlawful presence to trigger the unlawful presence bar, they're going to need to travel outside the United States to obtain their visa. Now, the unlawful presence bar can be 3 or 10 years, as most of you already know, and it depends on your particular length of unlawful presence. The next slide, please. So, the rules are laid out there. If you are unlawfully present for more than 180 days but less than a year, then you are barred from returning to the United States for 3 years. And if you've been unlawfully present in the United States for a year or more, and notice it's a year or more, not over a year, but a year or more, you trigger a 10-year bar before you can return to the United States if you should leave. And it's USCIS that is the agency that is solely responsible for the adjudication of the unlawful presence bar waiver. Next slide. The next slide is hung up. Oh, there we go. Now, the traditional waiver is showing, as I mentioned under the opening. Their traditional waiver is for those that have U.S. citizen children. U.S. citizen or permanent resident parents, or U.S. citizen or permanent resident spouses that can show extreme hardship to their family member. Now, unfortunately, the current process, the waiting period is very long. Those have reported a number of months, at least a year, and perhaps longer, of waiting overseas, because that is under the current process. The only way the waiver could be obtained is after an immigrant visa interview, and then there is a refusal by the consular official, and then from there, there is an application filed that is passed on to the USCIS for adjudication. And, of course, if a person is under the 10-year bar and the waiver is denied, that means they are separated for 10 years. Next slide. Now, the change is this. Immediate relatives, that is, spouses and children of U.S. citizens, are able now, when the rule becomes final, but the proposed rules that will enable them to be eligible for the provisional waiver, while they're in the U.S., they can petition before traveling to the consulate for the immigrant visa. It will allow them to return to the United States without any difficulty after receiving their visa. And basically, that means that provided there is no other ground of inadmissibility and they, in all respects, meet the qualifications for the visa category, they will be issued the visa and the provisional visa waiver that is issued by USCIS before they go becomes a permanent visa waiver, waiver of the unlawful presence bar upon their returning to the United States. So the thought is that many families will be able now to come forward and process their cases in the United States and know before they go of their status of the waiver being approved or not. Next slide. Now, what we have to understand is this doesn't create any new kind of law. It just changes the process for a select group, not for permanent residents who qualify for the to ask for waivers, to their spouse or to their children, but only to U.S. citizens who seek a waiver, unlawful presence waiver, on behalf of their spouse or on behalf of their children. However, if you don't qualify for this provisional processing, you still can process under the traditional processing as we all know it. And, of course, the extreme hardship is the key to all applications for this unlawful presence waiver. Next slide. This provisional waiver cannot be used for adjustment of status. It cannot be used if you're overseas and for some reason decide to come back to finish the processing of your case by adjustment in the United States. It is only available to be used once approved provisionally by USCIS to be used at a consular immigrant visa interview. And, of course, you have to be otherwise admissible to be eligible for the provisional waiver to take effect. Now, questions have been submitted to us in advance about when will this take effect. Of course, the proposed rule is only that, and it warns that no application will be adjudicated under a proposed rule. It must be a final rule. When that may occur, I'm not sure, but perhaps the next speaker, Ellen Gallagher, would know, have an inkling of when USCIS may propose a final rule being published. Now, if you look at the proposed regulations, and the citation to them is found in the additional reference material that's provided at the end of the of the presentation of the PowerPoint under resources, you'll see several topics that are that I want to amplify. The filing procedures. There will be a new form created for the filing. It's called an I-601A. And, of course, it will be similar to the I-601. You'll file all of your supporting documents showing extreme hardship and relationship. And there may or may not be an interview. It's not required, but USCIS may, in individual cases, require a waiver, and that will be, of course, in the United States with the applicant and the U.S. citizen who is the sponsoring family member. To be eligible, just basic factors. You must be present in the United States at the time of filing and the time of biometrics being processed. And upon your departure, you must solely be inadmissible for unlawful presence ground and no other grounds. You have to qualify as immediate relative, and in fact, you have to have an approved immediate relative petition. Further, you must have processed the immigrant visa case with the Department of State and proof of the processing fees paid with the Department of State. And that is the processing fee at the Visa Center. The applicant must depart the U.S. to obtain the immigrant visa and, of course, must show the qualifying extreme hardship to the U.S. citizen, spouse, or parent. Now, grounds of ineligibility, things to be careful of that the proposed regs are requiring. If the service has reason to believe that the person may be subject, and that's the grounds, reason to believe, they don't have to be certain, but only reason to believe that the applicant may be subject to grounds of inadmissibility other than unlawful presence, the person will be deemed ineligible for the provisional waiver consideration. Of course, the applicant is under the age of 17 will be ineligible since you're not accruing unlawful presence until you reach age 18. Further, the applicant has been scheduled for an immigrant visa interview at a U.S. embassy or a consulate abroad at the time the application is received will be deemed ineligible. This was a judgment call on behalf of the USCIS that if a case has progressed that far, it's too difficult and too cumbersome in the system to allow for a provisional filing here, holding up the case overseas, and then pursuing the provisional waiver afterwards. The applicant is in removal proceedings that have not been terminated or dismissed, ineligible to apply. If there's been a charging document, that is, the notice to appear to initiate removal proceedings, is pending, although not yet filed, it still will make the person ineligible until the NTA is canceled. Also, many have administratively closed cases in removal proceedings because of the current policy on prosecutorial discretion. However, they're going to be ineligible unless the case is reopened and issuance of a final voluntary departure order. Now, this brings into play that voluntary departures are limited to 120 days. So there is an interesting problem that immigration has presented. If someone has the clock ticking for voluntary departure, will immigration be able to process the I-601A in the United States and have the person be able to go overseas before the expiration of the voluntary departure order? So I have some suggestions that I'll come up with the Q&A of perhaps ways to deflect that problem. Next, the person is ineligible if they're subject to a final order of removal or an in absentia order of removal. Also, the applicant is ineligible if they're subject to reinstatement of a prior removal order under 241A-B, A-5, and that is where a person has been ordered removed and they enter without inspection, without permission afterwards. The applicant also is ineligible if they have a pending application for adjustment of status with USCIS, or the applicant has filed a previous provisional unlawful presence waiver application. You just get one. In one case only, not one for each case that you try. Now, if you do get an approval, the person still does not have legal status, and on the website of DHS it makes that clear. However, there in the preface in the proposed regulations, it states exactly that DHS does not envision, that's the words that are used, issuing an NTA while they're waiting for the immigrant visa interview overseas. And, of course, they need to be pursuing the immigrant application overseas with diligence, not just merely that they filed it and walked away from it. And once the person does receive the immigrant visa based upon this provisional waiver and they're issued a visa to return to the United States as an immigrant, that waiver is a permanent waiver, and the person's status should be secure as an immigrant. Now, what happens if there is a denial? This takes some thought about whether you have a strong enough case to file or not, because certain things can happen, including an NTA being issued. But first of all, you can get a denial without necessarily receiving an RFE or an NOID, NOID. And in fact, the proposed regulations do not contemplate ever issuing a NOID, but they do contemplate issuing an RFE by USCIS where the person is unrepresented and they haven't submitted the sufficient material to show extreme hardship of the qualifying relative, U.S. citizen. They don't mention specifically if they're represented aliens, will they get an RFE, but I suspect there's going to be some flexibility, especially in the beginning, until we find as sort of an equilibrium of the kind of material that immigration is expecting on these kind of cases to show extreme hardship. Now, even if you're denied, it's without prejudice, of course, to filing at the traditional I-601 at the U.S. consulate abroad. However, if it is denied, you can't get it reviewed by appeal. It's discretionary and non-reviewable. There are no motions to reopen or reconsider that may be filed directly by the applicant. However, the proposed regulation does suggest that the service on its own motion, which is called sua sponte motion to reopen or reconsider, pursuant to HCFR 103.585, would be available. The question becomes, though, how do you bring it to the attention of the USCIS that they have made a clear error in its denial? And I'll talk more about that in the Q&A. And that is the final point is that I mentioned in the beginning is that you could be placed in removal proceedings. You have no protection. You're under the standard rules of USCIS when they issue or don't issue for removal proceedings. And, of course, even if you are issued, there is the possibility of prosecutorial discretion to get a case administratively closed under current guidelines. Now, again, I have to repeat, though, that nothing can be filed yet to request this provisional waiver until a final rule is published and it has an effective date. And then those waiting now are still stuck with the current waiver process. And, in fact, if you do go ahead and file, it will be rejected and the person returned until there is a final rule. And I believe that's it.
Thanks so much, Thomas. We have a question here that I think we might want to just address now rather than waiting for the Q&A, and that's what does RFE and NOID mean?
Request for evidence is RFE, and that typically is when you're filing an application in any context for a family sponsorship, job sponsorship, immigration is not satisfied with the amount of evidence you've provided, and they have not made up their mind about the case. They just want to see more evidence. They specifically issue a request for evidence on the standard I-797 form and go through a whole list of questions and documents they want responded to. The NOID is a notice of intent to deny, and that is where immigration has preliminarily decided that it finds that the case should not be approved, and therefore you're given a specific amount of time to respond to its concerns. Otherwise, the case will be denied, and, of course, could still be denied even if you submit additional information.
Great. Thanks so much for clarifying that, Thomas.
You're welcome.
Now we're going to move on to Reverend Rosanna Panizzo. So, Rosanna, if you would like to press star 6 to make sure you're unmuted and talk about how communications can help.
Yes, thank you for the invitation. Actually, patients and communities of faith have been already supporting families, not only in regard to this specific situation, but in regard to the whole spectrum of new immigrants, documented and undocumented here in the United States. But evidently, more hands are needed. And one of the first things that I have learned, I'm an immigrant myself. I've been here for 15 years now in North Carolina. And I have learned to listen carefully to these new neighbors and friends and communities coming from different countries, quite different, from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America, mainly. So we need to educate ourselves as people of faith, trying to establish meaningful relationships with migrant families. And language should not be a problem because children and youngsters speak English already. So, they are the ones that need to understand the complexity of immigration law here in the United States. So we are providing emotional support for husbands, wives, but especially children, as I have mentioned, because it is so difficult for adults to understand the complexity of the law. So you can imagine a child trying to understand why their parents need to be separated at some point. And for sure, we need to provide material support. many communities of faith are already providing food. They are providing some funds for the families to be able to pay some bills, mainly because some of the families and the relatives have no jobs at this point. So the material support is important. It's not all, but it is important for this kind of community that we're trying to serve. Then there's a lot of misinformation when to apply for this possibility. And I have attended several families in several of my parishes that are already asking if they can apply for this. And there are some people that are offering them things that are not real in terms of the provision of the law. So we need to network in with community organizations that provide legal services. And we have many now community organizations that are involved in these kind of services in our neighborhood, in our state. And that's one big effort that we need to provide as well. Finally, we need to network with communities of faith. We talk about the Catholicity, one of the marks of the communities of faith. That means universal, and we have communities of faith from different branches all over the world. And several of these families, because deportation proceedings, for example, they have are coming back to their home countries. And they're, in many cases, they're coming back to countries where in which they have left before, but the children are not aware of this. They don't know anything about these countries. And in many cases, there are very few relatives that are remain in those areas, especially in the areas in which violence is an everyday other complication, in Central America, mainly. So to network with communities of faith in those other countries that are receiving those immigrants back is so important, because they need, again, the emotional support, the material support as well in their process, you know, of waiting or in the process of getting settled back towards home countries. For sure, this reality is very painful for the families. There are lots of needs of counseling and constantly, because this is a dilemma that has not been resolved yet. So it's a long way. It's a long way to go. And the families need to understand these terms of the future that they will be facing in terms of the law provisions.
Great. Thanks so much, Reverend. That was very helpful for us to know how we can be involved in our communities.
You're welcome.
Next, we're going to hear from Ellen Gallagher, who is the Senior Ombudsman in the Department of Homeland Security Office of the CIS Ombudsman. Ellen?
Thank you so much. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to join this event. I just want to confirm that you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. And with regard to Mr. Elliott's question, let me just address that. I do not know when USCIS may propose publication of a final rule on this topic. I am not employed by USCIS for the purpose of the individuals on the call. I just want to clarify to the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services Ombudsman's Office reports to the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. It is not part of USCIS. It does, however, have an important role in assisting individuals and employers in need of help when it comes to problems with USCIS. We work to address individual case inquiries, and we recommend ways to fix the systemic issues or problems that we see as we do casework. The Ombudsman's Office was established in 2002. It is designed to be an independent, confidential, and impartial influence within the Department of Homeland Security. And in your material, you should have reference, for example, to our most recent newsletter we released a week ago. I would encourage you to look at that newsletter, look at the range of topics that are covered. The 601 waiver is one topic that we have looked at in that newsletter. And you can also sign up to receive copies in the future. So what I wanted to mainly offer to the individuals on the call is an affirmation that we exist, that whether with regard to the 601 waiver process or any other difficulty that you may encounter seeking immigration benefits or services, you may want to consider invoking the assistance of the Ombudsman's Office. And so the question is, how exactly might you do that? I want to go through the three key steps as to how you could contact us. And the first step is that before you do reach out to the Ombudsman's Office, whether by telephone, through email, or online by generating a request for assistance, we ask that you first try to resolve whatever difficulty you're having through normal USCIS channels. Those channels might, again, be by going to the CIS website and looking for case status or information, perhaps contacting the National Customer Service Center through the 1-800 number, or making an appointment to speak directly with a USCIS representative through the InfoPass program, perhaps just going straight into a USCIS district office. If after attempting through normal channels to resolve your difficulty, you have been unable to do so, you can go to our website, which is, again, listed in your material, but I'll repeat for the benefit. It's www.dhs.gov /CIS Ombudsman. On our website, we have a specific form. It's called the DHS 7001. And it's easy to navigate. You can complete it on the website and submit it. Once you submit a signed request and supporting documentation, we can then begin to try to help in your case. Again, you can do that by email, by fax. You can even mail it directly. The reason that we encourage people to complete the DHS 7001, and that includes a signature, is that we can then represent certain information about your otherwise confidential case. So to go to CIS to work with the agency, we may have to share some personally identifying information, and it's important that we have your consent to do that. So that's the value of the 7001. And if you're represented by an attorney, for individuals represented by an attorney or other accredited representative, we also need what's called a G28 notice of appearance for that individual. So that's a brief snapshot of how you might reach out to our office, seek our help, and once we have an inquiry, we then proceed through a variety of channels to try to resolve the presented problem. We also consider things on an expedited basis if there are urgent, time-sensitive factors, and in that respect, we try to resolve cases within a week, roughly. Otherwise, you know, it might take us up to 30 days to try to work through the aspects of the case to bring it to resolution. I will pause there and hope for some questions during the Q&A session.
want to know, we have quite a lot of resources that we'll send around again. They were in the initial email that I sent this morning about the webinar link, but we'll make sure to send them around so everyone has information about how to contact the Ombudsman's office and get on their quarterly update list and form those relationships. But there's also quite a lot of other reading materials on this issue, on the Family Unity Waiver. So please also take the time to read through some of those reports and documents. At this time, I'd like to open up the call for a Q&A. So if anyone has a question, please unmute yourself, press star 6, and begin by introducing yourself, providing your name, affiliation, and location, and then directing your question to one of our three speakers, either Thomas, Reverend Rosanna, or Ellen Gallagher. Do we have any questions on the phone? Please press star 6 to unmute yourself. No questions?
Hi, this is no question, but Diana, the Episcopal Church in Seattle. And
hi.
I just want to thank you. This has been very, very helpful.
Great. And right now on the screen, I also have the contact information for the steering committee members of the Interfaith Immigration Coalition. So you can always reach out to your national policy organizer and expert who's on this list to follow up. It looks like we have a call as well for Ellen. Is there something to see the process towards a final rule? And can that person please identify yourself? AFSC. Okay, Ellen, is there anything that the advocates in the field can be doing to speed up the process towards getting a final rule so that they can be filing these family unity waivers?
Thank you. I keep muting on and off because of all the sirens behind me, but absolutely fine question, not really within the purview of the Ombudsman's Office to answer. I'll just affirm what you, though, indicated, which is there's a tremendous amount of valuable information in the PowerPoint, and I think that some of the links to advocacy organizations would probably be valuable in trying to secure concrete, you know, suggestions around concrete steps to explore and potentially push for quick, publication of a final rule.
This is Tom Elliott. There are a couple of questions that I had received beforehand. One was, what is the cost to apply? And it's no different than the current cost of the 601, that is the I-601A, and biometrics fee will be $585 and $85 respectfully. How does the new policy affect undocumented parents of citizen children? Unfortunately, the policy doesn't change the statute, and they will not be eligible, just as they're not eligible under the current statute for an unlawful presence waiver. And finally, the other question, a final question was, what if people have two waivers, and can they be considered under this process? Possibly, provided that if you have, for example, permission to reapply waiver of someone who is ordered removed, and is eligible to process in the United States for that waiver, that may be one exception that's permitted, because the ineligibility grounds, if you recall, has to be subject to other grounds of ineligibility at the time of the immigrant visa interview that's projected, will the person not have that waiver secured. So theoretically, if you have an unlawful presence waiver that's required in addition to advance permission to reapply after deportation, you could get the latter approved in advance and therefore only have one waiver that's required at the time of the interview overseas with the consular official.
Great, thanks. And something that Reverend Rosanna touched on that I just want to point out is once the final rule does come out, I think it's very important for our communities to be educating people about the danger of notarios. We're seeing it already with deferred action for childhood arrivals. We really need to be doing a lot in the community to educate on the dangers of notarios and making sure that people actually find a reputable immigration attorney, licensed immigration attorney, rather than turning to notarios. Are there any other questions? Well, great. I want to thank you all for joining our monthly webinar.
Hi. Oh, Diane in Seattle again. I am looking for that list of the steering committee, and I can't find it. Can you send that? That would be really helpful.
Sure. Are you on the webinar, or are you just on the phone right now?
No, I'm just on the phone, and I don't know that in the Seattle area we have a particular contact. We actually work through the New Sanctuary movement, Washington New Sanctuary.
There are affiliates of many of the interfaith immigration groups in Seattle. I, for one, know that the American Jewish Committee has a Seattle office. We're happy to put you in contact with some of those local offices of the Interfaith Immigration Coalition members. And you can find all of the members of the Interfaith Immigration Coalition interfaithimmigration.org under About Us. And also, I will be sending around a PDF of this PowerPoint, so you will also see the names there.
That'll be really helpful for us, too. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for your question, Diane. If there are no more questions, I want to thank you all for joining us today for our monthly Interfaith Immigration Coalition webinar. We will be doing another webinar next month. We hope you all will stay and I give a to Thomas, Reverend Rosanna, and Ellen also for speaking on the issue. And as always, feel free to follow up with me or any of the other members of the Interfaith Coalition for information on this issue or any of the other immigrants that we all work on. So thank you all so much for your time this afternoon. Great. Okay.